Yes, guys, what's good? You tuned into Mango Masala, Pi Radio South Asian Show. My name's Gaines and I'm here with Simran.
Hi.
Where have you been?
Part life.
Fair enough. Yeah,
what can I say?
I mean, you've already given me your review, but for the listeners out there, how was it?
Guys, I'm going back next year. I don't even care. Like, I don't even care. I was the one that was like, okay, 3 years in the remote part life. So embarrassing. I'm not telling anyone. Listen, 3 years and proud. It's going to be four. I had so much fun.
Do you think as well, like, I don't think you've ever been to a camping festival, have you?
But I, you know what? If you'd asked me a year ago, I'd say that I could do it once. Now I don't think I have it in me. I don't even think I could do it once.
I agree, because I haven't been to both camping and day festivals. There is just something about being able to go home at the end of it. And even though it feels like effort at the time, like the trek home and all the trams and whatever, like it's still, you can still like have a nice shower and get a proper night's sleep and everything. It's so much better than going back to your tent and being uncomfortable and not being properly showered. And yeah, it's not.
What I don't want is someone in a bucket hat weeing on my tent when I'm just trying to get a good night's sleep. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've seen the horror stories.
Yeah. Thankfully that hasn't happened to me, but.
But like, do you know, like, this year wasn't even that bad getting home. It was actually really straightforward comparatively, because other years have been like hell on earth trying to get back. Nothing beats a Premier Inn shower after a park life. That honestly, unmatched. I don't think I have it in me to do a camping festival. I really value my warm shower and my sleep too much.
Yeah. No, 100%. I don't think you will see me at another camping festival in my lifetime.
Glasgow, yeah. I feel like everyone says that you have to do it, but I just don't think I could do the camping side of it.
Yeah, I mean, there are options to do Glasgow and do, like, glamping versions.
But isn't that so expensive?
It will be, but I feel like if you were going to go Glasgow, I feel like you'd probably pull out all the stops, isn't it? Like, the fact that I've been now, I don't feel really any desire to go back, because also it's kind of like I've been once, I can say I've been to Glastonbury, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. But it was fun, and if you see me there next year, mind your business. And oh my god, I just love Disclosure. Love Disclosure before, love them so much now. Just insane at what they do. Like, me and my friend were talking about, like, who is, like, seen as, like, a heavyweight DJ. Like, you have, like, David Guetta, Calvin Harris, like, loads of people that, like, they are so good, but they are, like, just DJs. They don't do, like, a lot of other things. And they're, like, you don't have that many famous DJs in that sense. Disclosure.
Yeah.
I would say that they're just so good.
Yeah. No, I think they're kind of due, like, a mainstream resurgence, because they've been going since, for, like, at least 10 years and, like, since their first mainstream hit. That's what I mean. They kind of give me a bit of nostalgia in that sense, because I remember being, like, in high school and, like, hearing them, and it was like some of the first type of dance music that I actually really enjoyed, apart from a period briefly before that where I tried to get into Skrillex and it lasted for like a week, and then I was like, why am I doing this to myself? Like, I don't really like dubstep that much, let's just put the phone down. Like,
love Skrillex. Fun fact about me is I went through a Skrillex phase when I was like 13, me and a few other people. Okay, I wasn't on my own. And we used to like deep side part, if you remember what Skrillex hair used to look like. Side part, all my hair was over on one side of my head, and the rest of it I just like slicked back really tight.
So you didn't decide to shave it?
I didn't commit, unfortunately, but that would have made for some great pictures.
Oh dear. But yes, so Skrillex did is on a track with I Had a Dream and Priya Raghu. Have you heard it, Taka? No, you should listen to it, it's really good.
Skrillex's rebrand needs to be studied.
Yeah. Anyway, going off topic, I wanted to talk about something that's been happening for me this past week that I just started thinking about now, because we briefly talked about your family before starting this call, and we'll get on to a bit of that in a bit. But I, this week, have gone deep into the idea of researching family trees and stuff. Mm-hmm. And the reason that I've done this is because someone actually reached out to me. And for those that don't know, I am actually on 23andMe, which is a DNA heritage website. I did
it's like social media.
Yeah. type in Carlos123 for your discount code. No, I did it for my 21st birthday because I'd always really, like, I always get fascinated by that kind of stuff. And I was like, I want to do it. I want to get my, like, graph that shows, like, where I'm from in the world and everything. And shock, it was literally the most obvious thing ever. It was, like, 49% South Asian, 12% French and German, and the rest British. Right. I was like, right, okay, well, that figures, doesn't it? Anyway, but it is interesting in that it shows you a little other stuff. And one thing that it also does is if you allow it, it lets you connect with other people that share your DNA. So these people are people that are related to you. And a lot of the time they're like it's very minimal. So they're like probably way long lost cousins. Like I've got quite a few people that live in America and stuff. And it's interesting. I don't know when that migration would have happened and whatever. But a person came up the other day that was the highest that it's ever been. Normally they're like 0.1% DNA match. This person was like a 2.4, 2.5, which is relatively high. Like it's like around second cousin level. So I was like, okay, this is interesting because I've never heard of this person. So I just like click connect because I was like, whatever, like let's just see what happens. And then they full on reached out to me. They were like, yeah, like I was adopted at birth. I am trying to like relocate my family. And I was like, okay, this is interesting. So I've been like this whole past week, like helping them out, like doing my own little bit of research and stuff. This is on my white side, by the way. But like I was like full on looking into it. And yeah, it turns out that it's my mum's second cousin. So it's my grandma's mum had a sister who had a daughter who gave him up for adoption. So it's like, yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And it's kind of made more complicated by the fact that my grandma didn't really speak to her mum very much because she left the family when my grandma was a teenager. So there's a whole other thing there. And probably I'm oversharing a bit here, but I also don't think my grandma's listening to this podcast. So I think it's fine. I'm going to take that liberty.
You can trauma dump on radio. That's yeah. Okay.
But, no, it's just been really cool. And because of this, I've obviously been trying to help this person out as well, because it's like, obviously they're related to me. And also I'm like, I really find it interesting as well. So I signed up for loads of free trials on like ancestry records things. And I've been like doing my like detective work and finding this person's mum was this and they were born at this time. And it's really interesting. And I've also been like stalking random people, like challenging myself. Could probably look you up some room. Anyone who's born in the UK, like their birth record is on there. Like not in 23andMe, it's this other thing. It's actually really bad when you think about that people can actually pay to view this information. Regardless, it really got me thinking about how easy it is if I really want to, for me to do that for my white side, because I've done it before, and my granddad also did it, and he's got like manual ones, but also, again, when I was looking, I literally managed to find on like one side, I went all the way back to like 1600s, so it's like, it's a big chain, but it just made me think about how easy it is for me to do that, but how hard it would be for me to do it for the other side. And I have been told, like, my Anka's family have spoken about how when people die in India especially, they tend to like do some kind of record of it, and then it's like that's like kind of like the family tree because it's like that. But I'm just a bit skeptical as to whether that would even exist for my family because of the obvious migration that happened. They lived like in what is now Pakistan as Hindus and fled during partition, so which would make me think, why would anyone retain that information? Do you know what I mean? Like surely it would get destroyed or lost or whatever. So yeah, I just thought it was quite interesting to think about how easy it is for me to find out one side but then not the other.
Wait, that's insane. You find your cousin?
Yeah, I mean they're my second cousin once removed, but yeah,
still.
Yeah.
You're half brown, you know that's your cousin.
Yeah, that's very true.
What's all this second cousin ones? What does that mean?
But Yeah, so they're my grandma's cousin's grandchild. They're my grandma's cousin's child, sorry. Yeah.
Grandma's cousin's child. Oh, so your uncle, aunt? Or is it your cousin?
They're my mum's second cousin, so they're my second cousin once removed. That's why, yeah.
I don't know what the once removed thing means, can't I?
It basically means that it's like one generation up.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Right, got ya.
Yeah, but it was really interesting for a while because obviously until we did the digging and found out, his grandma is my grandma's auntie. Before that, it was like, wait, we're related, but this isn't adding up. Like, did someone have some naughty business at some point? Like, there was like 2 days there was 2 days where I was kind of a bit like, ooh, what's going on here? But turns out it was all legit, so, yeah.
Imagine that's how, like, I bet so many people have found out some messed up information through these websites.
Well, that's what Mayanka really wants to do it, but then she's like, what if we find a way related? I mean, it's very unlikely, but...
I'd cry. I'd cry so much.
But
yeah, I mean, obviously, when like people like our grandparents and stuff migrated over, I think a lot of that documentation got, excuse the pun, lost in transport. Like it just...
Yeah.
Lost, destroyed. I don't know what the situation was, but like, I think a lot of it is just no longer with us. So it's a shame, but at least like from their generation onwards, everything's a lot better documented. So like for the next generation, they'll be able to.
Carlos Ganani lived in Stockport. Wow. Well, along those lines and to round this topic off.
I was going to really go on the tangent there.
Right, let me just tell you this first. The furthest that I got back in terms of my relatives in the 1600s.
Oh guess my where god, they, that's so far back.
Yeah, guess where they lived.
Slough. Stockport.
Your favourite place. Manchester. Your not favourite place.
My not favourite place? Birmingham.
Close. You've lived
Nottingham.
There. Yeah. Selston. Do you know where is? Selston in Nottinghamshire.
No,
I don't know.
No clue.
Yeah. But yeah.
Wow.
Fun fact.
I wonder what was going on in Nottingham in the 1600s.
Probably met Shakespeare.
Oh, maybe actually, because he was from Warwick.
Yeah, it's not that far away.
Well, good for them.
Yeah. Good. Well done, everyone. Anyway, and that was a nice little bit of an opener before we get into a relatively or incredibly more serious topic. I have really wanted to speak about this because I'm aware that we haven't necessarily gone into this event in that much detail in the like four nearly years that we've been doing this radio show, but this month marks the 4th anniversary of it. I'm sorry, not 4th, 40th anniversary of it. So 1984, which made me think we should really discuss this. And obviously the past couple of weeks, also Simran's been doing park life. And as our resident Sikh person, I was like, it's not right for us to discuss this without you. In case you haven't caught on what I'm talking about us discussing the 1984 Sikh genocide in India. So just to give a little bit of background about this, in case anyone isn't aware, in 1984, in June, there were a series of pogroms against Sikhs in India. This was following the assassination of the Indian Prime Minister, Indira Gandhi, by her bodyguards who were also Sikh. So Gandhi's assassination was triggered by Operation Blue Star. And this was a military action that she had ordered in order to secure the Harminder Sahib temple complex, which is in Amritsar in Punjab. This led to backlash from the Sikh community. They had wanted greater rights for Sikhs and also autonomy for Punjab for a long time. And many saw this Operation Blue Star as an assault on their religion and cultural identity.
Can I butt in there?
Yeah, go
real,
on.
Real quick. I was go just going to say, like, the Operation Blue Star itself was, like, a militarized assault on the Harminder Sahib, which for Sikhs is, like, the biggest holy temple, like, the biggest holy place in our entire religion. It's, like, where the birth of our religion is thought to be. And it, to this day, is still, like, a massive, the most integral part of the religion.
Yeah.
The... Oh, sorry.
Also, it kind of reminds me of similar how we talked about the Ram Mandir in India, like similar sort of thing where like it is very important to religions other than Hindus, yet there's kind of like trying to stake a claim on it kind of thing.
Yes, exactly. And I think like, so Operation Blue Star was basically, from a lot of accounts, they believed that a certain activist in the Sikh community, Bindranwale, was there. He was there in that in the Harmandir Sahib with like his team and everything. So that was why it was thought to be that they were going to impose this military action on the area. Once I think the operation kind of went public, Indira Gandhi was assassinated by her two Sikh bodyguards, which is what caused the, what I have read on Google as they've labeled it as the anti-Sikh riots.
Yeah, that's basically what, that is exactly what happened. So, I mean, before that, Gandhi was even assassinated, around 500 civilians had been killed in the clashes that were already happening.
Oh yeah, it was very like civil tensions was extremely high at this time.
Yeah, so like around 500 people had already died before Gandhi was assassinated, but once she was assassinated, it really led to this massacre against Sikhs at large in the region. So figures vary in terms of how many actually died. It's definitely in the thousands, but I've seen some ranging from around 4,000 to 17,000. So. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, it's the same as like other types of communal violence that we've seen in the South Asian subcontinent, such as like partition, where literally the figures are unattainable because of how much violence actually took place.
But I think as well, like the figures are unattainable because like many of the other like civil acts of like just civil wars, tiny little things that have happened, like in the subcontinent, the numbers are not known to us accurately because a lot of it was swept under the rug.
Yeah.
A lot of it is anecdotal that you find out passed down through generations or from hearsay, especially like at the time when we didn't have the news as we know it, like social media and stuff like that. Like everything was very anecdotal. Everything was passed along. So there were no official records of the numbers in this instant. But you know, I guarantee, like, if you know a Sikh or Punjabi person, they were either affected or they know someone who was affected.
For sure. I mean, when I think of someone who's Sikh, a lot of the time I do think of someone who is ultimately Punjabi. So it makes sense that, like, this, I'm guessing that Sikhism does originate from that region. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that a lot of people are obviously affected by this.
Yeah. Amritsar, where the Harmandir Sahib is considered like our holy place. If I was to like draw any kind of comparison to it, it would literally be like Vatican City.
Yeah.
For Christians.
Or like Mecca, maybe like going to
And it would be like an opposing government come in with guns and military action and take fire on that area.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the thing as well. Obviously, any type of violence is horrific, but some of the descriptions of what actually went on here is just horrible. Like, so innocent men, women, and children being raped, tortured, and killed in front of their own family members, all under this pretense of they're an enemy of the state.
And I think, like, when Indira Gandhi was assassinated, it basically fueled the fire for this anti-Sikh like hate to come about, and then a lot of like paramilitarized legions of far right like Hindu groups were definitely a lot more legitimized in their opinions and emboldened in their very, very violent responses, as Carlos like outlined. Like, so many people were abused and tortured, assaulted, sexually assaulted, and killed just for being Sikh. And like you said, like the numbers vary so much because we just don't know.
Yeah, and haven't I seen like as well that during this operation there were various the way in which it was carried about, like they made it like an emergency, they called it an emergency, so they were able to actually like act as they wanted in the name of avoiding any further damage. And I think there was also media blackouts as well, so like say a lot of it swept under the rug. Mm-hmm. And
I think a lot of it, like there was a lot of media censorship at the time. Sikhs were very much villainized, labels as terrorists. There was very much like the us and them kind of approach, the rhetoric used in media outlets, very much like vilifying Sikh and Punjabi people, and justifying these acts of violence towards our community. I think that is what largely contributed to like the average person taking up arms at that point and like going out and like conducting violent acts. And it went on for so long, and there were so many riots and so many people lost their lives because of it. There was also like coordinated attacks, like militarized attacks on gurdwaras. So like, I think at one point, like there was like 125 gurdwaras at the same time were attacked. And it was like, at the time, everyone was so confused. No one could reach out to loved ones. People were taking like hospice, and like they were like taking, what's the word I'm looking for? Like,
refuge,
that's the word, in gurdwaras. And that's, and like the government knew that, right? Because that was the only place that people could find that sense of solidarity and community and felt safe, because that was supposed to be a protected space. It was supposed to be a protected area. And they coordinated simultaneous attacks on these places because they knew everyone would be there, and no one had the means to go and contact people and say like gurdwaras aren't safe, you know. Alongside the like media blackouts and then just the general like controlling the narrative to kind of vilify the Sikh people, the Central Sikh Reference Library was also destroyed, and many like artifacts were vandalized or just completely destroyed in an attempt to erase heritage and kind of any trace. And I think that largely contributes to like the non-violent side of like how this was definitely a genocide attempt.
Definitely. Like, yeah, it's like, it's similar to what we're seeing in Palestine currently. Mm-hmm. When we think genocide, you think lots of people dying, and ultimately it is that, lots of people being killed, but there is, mm-hmm. there's so much more to it. It is ultimately an attempt to erase a certain demographic of people.
Yeah, completely. And you can 100% draw so many parallels between what's happening now in Palestine versus what happened in India in 1984, and Punjab in 1984. And I just think like the non-violent side of it, like the erasure of this heritage and like trying to control the narrative, and this definite like justification of why people are acting like this, like under Hamas or like under Bindranwale. Like it's a very like, it's very scary.
Yeah. I mean, again, just for the record, if there is anyone out there who's like wanting to play devil's advocate, obviously we're not saying that anyone should have died or be killed, including Prime Minister Gandhi. Like, that obviously shouldn't have happened. But like, that doesn't mean that we can't point out like the horrific attack on the group of people that were mm-hmm. Sikhs. That can't, you, doesn't mean that we can't point out that that did happen, and that mm-hmm. many ancestors of those peoples are still reeling from the effects of that today. Like, I think I really saw it at the start of this month when I saw how many of the Sikh people that I follow on socials, how many people were sharing about this, and it really like struck a chord as to how much of a big thing this is for people. And I think as well, something that's particularly why people feel a certain sense of, feel very much angst about this, is because not very many people have actually been held accountable for what happened here. So it was only in 2011 that the Human Rights Watch reported that the government of India has yet to prosecute those responsible for the mass killings. And also, when there were the WikiLeaks leaks in 2011, it was revealed that the US was convinced that Indian National Congress's complicity in the riots did exist. And they called it opportunism and hatred by the Congress government of Sikhs. So even though that isn't an official statement by the US, it's been revealed that that is what they believe has happened here. And even now, there's only been to date one really high profile conviction of someone mm-hmm. who was involved. I think it was in 2018, and it was the Congress leader at the time, Sajjan Kumar. But the fact that we're 30 years down the line with all this advanced technology and whatever, and still only one person has been properly held to account for what's gone on here. Like,
and I think, like, I was saying this to Carlos before we started recording, like, this was a very tricky thing to come on and speak about, because to this day, it's almost like there are a lot of sympathizers and apologists for what happened. And it's almost a lot of people do still think that, like, nothing was really wrong and nothing really happened. And I think it's hard to come out and speak about it because there's a lot of people that I've seen on social media, like, try and shut it down in attempts of just being like, it didn't happen sort of thing, when it very much did. And it was only 40 years ago. Like, my mum was a teenager when it happened, right? Like, it still very much, like, it very, very, very closely affected my family. And so many families that I know of, and so many people were involved, and, like, it was only 40 years ago. People's parents went through this, let alone their grandparents, who were, like, there and active and, like, in the midst of it all. People are still very much traumatized from this, and it's something that as a community we won't forget. And if I know my people, I know, like, we're very, like, strong and resilient in that sense. And it's something that I was always taught about growing up, and I just think that is what this whole month is about. It's about remembrance for those who attained their Shahidi in June 1984, those who were killed, and just for, like, just to remember that the lives were lost. And then that's it, really.
Yeah, and I think it also explains why there is still similar sentiment that the Sikh people were feeling in 1984 to this day, in terms of wanting greater rights for people, and why certain movements do advocate for the autonomy of Punjab as well.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, the fight is far from over. We've spoken about this on this show since this show was created, about, like, the riots that have happened in Punjab, the farmers' protests, which were very high profile, very highly covered. We covered it a lot on this show, like, and they are still very much ongoing. That was last year. Do you know what I mean? Like, so the fight is very much not over. But I think it's times like this where we just, like, 40 years, like, remembering what had happened, but also not forgetting the fact that it was still, you know, relatively very recent and still very much affects people to this day.
Definitely. Thank you, Simran.
Thank you.
Right. Positive rounding off Don Toliver album review. I have to admit, I wasn't even aware he had dropped an album. But
you suck.
Sorry, I'm too busy focusing on Charlie XCX.
One thing I will never talk bad about on this show, yeah, but I will talk about it in private, is Taylor Swift.
Oh. See, I don't know. Right.
I love Charlie XCX.
Yeah, same.
Brat should be number one. As of recording, I'm pretty sure it's not number one. Brat's a great album.
No, I agree.
Carlos, you talk. I need to find out if it's number one.
It's not.
It's not still.
It's no. Well, no, because they've only done it 1 week. Brat's only been out for 1 week. But for the people that are wondering, there's been a bit of controversy, and this is all allegations and whatever. There's no actual real concrete proof as to anything that's happened. But basically, Charlie XCX released her latest album, Brat, on June 7th, I believe, which meant that it was up for its first charting position last Friday on June 14th. Now, the official charts company released stuff, like, they're like anticipations of it in the middle of last week, and they were saying it's looking very much like it's Charlie XCX and Bon Jovi head to head, but Charlie's on set to have her first number one album, blah blah blah, great, whatever. Also, Asian representation, Gujarati queen. Literally,
Charlie XCX is Gujarati.
She's half Gujarati.
I did not know.
No, her mum's Gujarati.
Let's go.
Right, exactly, right. So but then Taylor obviously is here doing Eras Tour, which, regardless of your opinions on her, very impressive that she obviously does, like, 3-hour shows and whatnot, and apparently it's boosting the economy as well. So, yeah, just outlining some positives of this. Anyway, obviously she's on a UK tour at the moment. She was at Liverpool last Thursday, Friday, Saturday. And
can I say one thing?
Right, go on.
I saw some stat about like Taylor Swift achieves like the most attended ever show in Anfield. And I was like, yeah, because that big patch of grass in the middle is usually used for something else.
That's true, to be fair. Like,
of course it's the most attended show. It's all seats, all standing.
Anyway.
Sorry, I'll stop. It's really not a fight I want to choose. It's really not a fan base I want to beef with.
Yeah. We're not trying to beef, please.
I am close friends with the Swiftie and I don't even try.
I'm married to one. Anyway.
I know. And I'm scared of her.
Yeah. She's literally going to see her tomorrow. So, yeah.
Is she in Manchester?
No, she's going to Wales, Cardiff. Yeah. Long. Anyway. Charlie released Brat was set to go to number one. Taylor was in the UK at the time. And on Thursday, Taylor decides to release another version of her latest album, The Tortured Poets Department.
Which is, I think, the 10th version of it.
The thing is as well, it was a limited version with basically like, I think, like original, it had like original voice notes of that she'd recorded of the songs, which you can see is kind of cool and whatever, but the point is it was limited and also it was UK only.
Yeah.
And the way that it was limited is that people were only able to actually purchase it until 11:59 PM on Thursday, which is also the time that the chart recording for the weekend. So, and obviously, inevitably, Taylor Swift got number one album on Friday. So there have been allegations, whatever you want to call it, that Taylor Swift did this on purpose in order to achieve the number one album spot in the UK. Now, I don't know what to think about this, because obviously there's every possibility that it's true. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if it's true, but then also I'm thinking, is Taylor really that bothered? Like, is she, like, did she, I really doubt anything personal if she did do on purpose. It's more just kind of like, me personally, I'm just kind of just a bit fed up of this.
I've seen it being labelled as, like, stat padding, and, like, she's just, like, doing new things to attempt to hold her reign at the top for longer and longer and like basically achieve records, which is like one thing, right? But if anyone did it, even if The Weeknd did it, 10 versions of an album is excessive. And like artists have had the same accusations for much less, and like people have like gotten their albums taken down just for releasing a deluxe version if it didn't have like enough like songs added onto it. So I think like being able to add a whole new version of your album in any case with just voice notes added to it. And then I just think like not accusing anyone of anything, but like it just seems all too in place, like the 11:59 thing specifically that day, UK only.
Yeah. This is the thing, because there's one argument that's like, well, why shouldn't she be able to go for records if that's what she wants to do and whatever? But I don't know, it just all feels very like capitalistic to me as well. Like this, like also the way that there's all these versions of the albums, and then obviously she's very much aware that her fan base is young girls. And who's gonna actually pay for this? Like, you know what I mean? I'm just, something just doesn't necessarily feel right about it, and that's my opinion. But yeah.
And you're not allowed to clip this and put it on social media, Carlos, but it can go on the podcast. Yeah. Just this one bit that I'm about to say. But Taylor Swift fans are terrifying, and like, it's a fan base that like they will stop at nothing to prove their point about her. Like they will defend her like it's their mother, and it's terrifying. Literally. And like I've seen the videos of like the screaming at the concerts and the new albums and the new songs, and I don't like it. It's a painful watch.
One thing I will say to end this on a positive note is that Taylor's last date at Anfield was on the 15th of April. And for those that don't know, that is the anniversary of the Hillsborough disaster. And I did see that a lot of Swifties, you know how they do the whole friendship bracelet thing at the events, a lot of them had left like bracelets at the memorial as like a symbol of respect, which is a very nice thing to do.
I'm not saying it's not nice. I'm not saying anything about the Eras tour is not nice. It's quite cute. It's quite sweet. It's just a really cool, a bit scary how big it is, like how one person can achieve that level.
It was a really cool concept, and I'm really interested to see as to whether any artists follow suit in terms of doing a similar thing. Like on Twitter the other day, I literally saw that someone did an example of, if Katy Perry was to do the Eras tour, and they had like a list of she'd do these songs from this album, these, like, it's a really cool thing because it's kind of like a greatest hits tour, but literally on steroids. That's not me saying that Taylor Swift is on steroids, but that's literally what it feels like, because it's 3 hours straight. Like, come on. Like, it's massive.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to downplay that, like, that achievement in itself. No way. But Bratford number one, mate.
No, I think Charlie deserves it as well.
I think Charlie deserves it. I'm a fan of her music, and I just love the pivot that she's done. And also, if you're free on the 11th of July, do you want to come to Ibiza with me to see her?
I will be in Thailand, so...
Boring.
But go for it.
Boring.
I'm sure that'll be great.
But yeah, I don't know.
Anyway, go back to Don Toliver.
Don Toliver, guys, he released an album. It's really good. What I like about Don Toliver... is that he's just unbothered, moisturized, in his lane, flourishing, Kaliuchi, baby. Like, so unproblematic, so not dramatic, so just is not trying to be something he's not, is just making his nice music and is living his life. He kind of goes off the scene a bit, comes back with a tour, comes back with an album, has a baby.
Good for him.
Like, he just makes great music, and it's not trying to be like serious or anything. It just sounds amazing, and his vocals are insane. But he's done a pivot with this album. It's gone like rock. It's like rock and roll. Like, it's all, there's a heavy metal-y kind of song as a second album in the song. And as you know, I'm a big fan of stuff like that. And I was listening to it, and I was thinking about like how the kind of like rock sound has influenced rap and trap music in the last decade and a half, with like Yeezus. I've said, like, Kanye, you know, like him or not, Yeezus was a really revolutionary album. The sound was just so different. And then I really like think that kind of sound inspired the likes of like Ken Carson, Playboi Carti, like Yeet, like these people that use like heavy guitar in their songs and like kind of have a sound that's a bit more like reminiscent of rock music. Not saying it is rock music, because people will get angry at that, but like that kind of sound. And Don Toliver really U-turned from the Loverboy era of his last album to like this like kind of harder, more rap focused, guitar focused, like heavy hitting album. And there are still some like Loverboy softer songs in it, which are really, really good. Two Travis Scott features. And really good album. And it kind of points me back to like the point that I make a lot about like, you just listen to what you want, man. Like, anything's cool. You don't have to listen to it because people say it's cool or not. Just if it sounds good, listen to it. Like, I know a lot of people would be like, oh, it sounds like rock. Like, that's not cool. But like, actually give it a go.
What a lovely way to finish.
Love you, Don Toliver.
Well, thank you, Simran. You've truly given us every single emotion today.
I've got my Don Toliver. My Don Toliver shirt is drying on the washing line outside. So if you literally look outside my window, it is his face, massive, just hanging there in my garden right now. And I love that.
I'll just pop in the car for 3 hours and just to see the
T-shirt. I'll take a picture. Okay. I should have worn it, though. Anyway.
That's really cool, though. I don't know anyone that, like, still uses, like, a proper washing line.
Are you being for real?
Yeah. Like, a lot of people, like, just dry their clothes inside. Like, I genuinely don't know anyone that uses, like, a proper... apart from my grandma. So...
Wait, are you being serious?
Yeah. Like, I don't
Everyone
really...
Everyone uses washing lines.
Not anymore.
Can we do like a poll on our Instagram story? Because I don't buy that for 1 second. Like everyone uses washing lines. Maybe it's a style thing. Can't be.
I'm just thinking that like I haven't like in the past twenty years ago I saw loads of people use their washing lines. Now that I don't see anyone use their washing lines.
But obviously you guys are in a flat, so it's a bit different.
Yeah, no, obviously I'm not, but I'm talking like so my auntie's family doesn't use one, my family doesn't use one.
So they put it on
one.
Like a clothes horse and yeah. Put it inside.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I do admit that I think it probably dries better. Like the air and stuff, like it's probably nicer.
Oh, we are old.
This is why I'm not disgusted by it. End the podcast.
We just went straight into millennial chat.
Does anyone still use a washing line?
I do want to know that. Can we put it on an Instagram story? I'm going to do it.
Well, you do. I'm not being responsible for this. Huh? Right. Goodbye, everyone.
Thanks, guys. Bye.